Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 193rd of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm Felbrig. Today we're starting off with the next part of the World War I adventure Greenmantle, and then we'll have a musical number from 1932, and then back for part 4 of the second story from The King in Yellow. Let's get started. Chapter 14, The Lady of Mantilla. Since that first night, I'd never clapped eyes on Sandy. It'd gone clean out of the world, and Blenkeron and I waited anxiously for a word of news. Our own business was in good trim, for we were presently going east towards Mesopotamia, but unless we learned more about Greenmantle, our journey would be a grotesque failure. And learn about Greenmantle we could not, for nobody by word or deed suggested his existence, and it was impossible, of course, for us to ask questions. Our only hope was Sandy, for what we wanted to know was the Prophet's whereabouts and his plans. I said to Blenkeron that we might do more to cultivate Frau von Einem, but he shut his jaw like a rat trap. "There's nothing doing for us in that quarter," he said. "That's the most dangerous woman on earth, and if she got any kind of notion that we were wise about her pet schemes, I reckon you and I would very soon be in the Bosporus." This was all very well, but what was going to happen if the two of us were bundled off to Baghdad with instructions to wash away the British? Our time was getting pretty short, and I doubted if we could spin out more than 3 days more in Constantinople. I felt just as I had felt with Stum that last night, when I was about to be packed off to Cairo and saw no way of avoiding it. Even Blenkeron was getting anxious. He played patience incessantly, and was disinclined to talk. I tried to find out something from the servants, but they either knew nothing or wouldn't speak. The former, I think. I kept my eyes lifted too, as I walked about the streets, but there was no sign anywhere of the skin coats or the weird stringed instruments. The whole company of the Rosy Hours seemed to have melted into the air, and I began to wonder if they had ever existed. Anxiety made me restless, and restlessness made me want exercise. It was no good walking about the city. The weather had become foul again, and I was sick of the smells and the squalor and the flea-bitten crowds. So Blenkeron and I got horses, Turkish cavalry mounts with heads like trees, and went out through the suburbs into the open country. It was a grey, drizzling afternoon, with the beginnings of a sea fog which hid the Asiatic shores of the straits. It wasn't easy to find open ground for a gallop, and there were endless small patches of cultivation and the gardens of country houses. We kept on the high land above the sea, and when we reached a bit of downland came on squads of Turkish soldiers digging trenches. Whenever we let the horses go, we had to pull up sharp for a digging party or a stretch of barbed wire. Coils of the beastly thing were lying loose everywhere, and Blenkeron nearly took a nasty toss over one. And then we were always being stopped by sentries and having to show our passes. Still, the ride did us some good, and shook up our livers, and by the time we turned for home I was feeling more like a white man. We jogged back into the short winter twilight, past the wooded grounds of white villas, held up every few minutes by transport wagons and companies of soldiers. The rain had come in on a real earnest, and it was two very bedraggled horsemen that crawled into the muddy lanes. As we passed one villa, shut in by a high white wall, a pleasant smell of wood smoke was wafted towards us, which made me sick for the burning veld. My ear, too, caught the twanging of a zither, which somehow reminded me of the afternoon in Capresso's garden house. I pulled up and proposed to investigate, but Blenkeron was very testy and declined. "Zithers are as common here as fleas," he said. "You don't want to be fossicking around somebody's stables and find a horseboy entertaining his friends. They don't like visitors in this country, and you'll be asking for trouble if you go inside those walls. I guess it's some old buzzard's harem." Buzzard was his own private peculiar name for the Turk, for he said that he had had, as a boy, a natural history book with a picture of a bird called the Turkey Buzzard, and couldn't get out of the habit of applying it to the Ottoman people. I wasn't convinced. So I tried to mark down the place. It seemed to be about 3 miles out of the city, at the end of a steep lane on an inland side of the hill coming from the Bosporus. I fancied somebody of distinction lived there, for a little further on we met a big empty motor car snorting its way up, and I had a notion that the car belonged to the walled villa. The next day, Blenkiron was in a grievous trouble with his dyspepsia. About midday he was compelled to lie down, and having nothing better to do, I had out the horses again and took Peter with me. It was funny to see Peter in a Turkish army saddle, riding with the long boar stirrup and the slouch of the back veld. That afternoon was unfortunate from the start. It was not the mist and the drizzle of the day before, but a stiff northern gale which blew sheets of rain in our faces and numbed our bridle hands. We took the same road, but pushed west of the trench-digging parties and got to a shallow valley with a white village amongst the cypresses. Beyond that, there was a very respectable road which brought us to the top of the crest that in clear weather must have given a fine prospect. Then we turned our horses, and I shaped our course so as to strike the top of the long lane that abutted the down. I wanted to investigate that white villa. But we hadn't gone far on our road before we got into trouble. It arose out of a sheepdog, a yellow mongrel brute that came at us like a thunderbolt. It took a special fancy to Peter and bit savagely at his horse's heels and sent it capering off the road. I should have warned him, but I did not realise what was happening until too late. For Peter, being accustomed to mongrels in Kaffir kraals, took a summary way with the pest. Since it despised his whip, he out with his pistol and put a bullet through its head. The echoes of the shot had scarcely died away when the row began. A big fellow appeared running towards us, shouting wildly. I guessed he was the dog's owner and proposed to pay no attention. But his cries summoned two other fellows, soldiers by the look of them, who closed in on us, unslinging their rifles as they ran. My first idea was to show them our heels, but I had no desire to be shot in the back, and they looked like men who wouldn't stop short of shooting. So we slowed down and faced them. They made as savage-looking a trio as you would want to avoid. The shepherd looked as if he'd been dug up, a dirty ruffian with matted hair and a beard like a bird's nest. The two soldiers stood staring with sullen faces, fingering their guns, while the other chap raved and stormed and kept pointing at Peter, whose mild eyes stared unwinkingly at his assailant. The mischief was that neither of us had a word of Turkish. I tried German, but it had no effect. We sat looking at them, and they stood storming at us, and it was fast getting dark. Once I turned my horse round as if to proceed, and the two soldiers jumped in front of me. They jabbered amongst themselves, and then one said very slowly, "He want pounds," and he held up 5 fingers. They evidently saw by the cut of our jib that we weren't Germans. "I'll be hanged if he gets a penny," I said angrily, and the conversation languished. The situation, however, was getting serious, so I spoke a word to Peter. The soldiers had their rifles loose in their hands, and before they could lift them, we had the pair covered with our pistols. "If you move," I said, "you're dead." They understood that all right, and stood stock still, while the shepherd stopped his raving and took to muttering like a gramophone when the record is finished. "Drop your guns," I said sharply. "Quick, or we shoot." The tone, if not the words, conveyed my meaning. Still staring at us, they let the rifles slide to the ground. The next second we had forced our horses on top of them, and the three were off like rabbits. I sent a shot over their heads to encourage them. Peter dismounted and tossed the guns into a bit of scrub where they would take some finding. This hold-up had wasted time, and by now it was getting very dark, and we hadn't ridden a mile before it was black night. It was an annoying predicament, for I'd completely lost my bearings, and at the best I had only a foggiest of notions of the lie of the land. The best plan seemed to be to try and get to the top of a rise in the hopes of seeing the lights of the city. But all the countryside was so pockety that it was hard to strike the right kind of rise. We had to trust to Peter's instinct. I asked him where our line lay, and he sat very still for a minute, sniffing the air, and then he pointed the direction. It isn't what I would have taken myself, but on a point like that, he was pretty near infallible. Presently we came to a long slope which cheered me, but at the top there was no light visible anywhere, only a black void like the inside of a shell. As I stared into the gloom, it seemed to me that there were patches of deeper darkness that might be woods. "There is a house half left in front of us," said Peter. I peered till my eyes ached and saw nothing. "Well, for heaven's sake, guide me to it," I said, and with Peter in front, we set off down the hill. It was a wild journey, for darkness clung as close to us as a vest. Twice we stepped into patches of bog, and once my horse saved himself by a hair from going head forward into a gravel pit. We got tangled up in strands of wire, and often found ourselves rubbing our noses against tree trunks. Several times I had to get down and make a gap in the barricades of loose stones. But after a ridiculous amount of slipping and stumbling, we finally struck what seemed the level of a road, and a piece of special darkness in front which turned out to be a high wall. I argued that all mortar walls had doors, so we set to groping along it and presently found a gap. There was an old iron gate on broken hinges which we easily pushed open, and found ourselves on the back path to some house. It was clearly disused, for masses of rotting leaves covered it, and by the feel of it underfoot, it was grass-grown. We dismounted now, leading our horses, and after about 50 yards the path ceased and came out on a well-made carriage drive. So at least we guessed, for the place was as black as pitch. Evidently the house couldn't be far off, but in which direction I hadn't a notion. Now I didn't want to be paying calls on any Turk at that time of day. Our job was to find where the road opened into the lane, for after that our way to Constantinople was clear. One side the lane lay, and the other the house, and it didn't seem wise to take the risk of trampling up with horses to the front door. So I told Peter to wait for me at the end of the back road, while I would prospect a bit. I turned to my right, my intention being that if I saw the light of a house, to return with Peter and take the other direction. I walked like a blind man in that nether pit of darkness. The road seemed well kept, and the soft wet gravel muffled the sounds of my feet. Great trees overhung it, and several times I wandered into dripping bushes, and then I stopped short in my tracks, for I heard the sound of whistling. It was quite close, about 10 yards away, and the strange thing was that it was a tune I knew, about the last tune you would expect to hear in this part of the world. It was the Scots air, Carr, the Yowls to the Nose, which was a favourite of my father's. The whistler must have felt my presence, for the air suddenly stopped in the middle of a bar. An unbounded curiosity seized me to know who the fellow could be, so I started in and finished it myself. There was silence for a second, and then the unknown began again and stopped. Once more I chipped in and finished it. Then it seemed to me that he was coming nearer. The air in that dark tunnel was very still, and I thought I heard a light foot. I think I took a step backward then, and suddenly there was the flash of an electric torch from a yard off, so quick that I could see nothing of the man who held it. Then a low voice spoke out of the darkness, a voice I knew well, and following it, a hand was laid on my arm. "What the devil are you doing here, Dick?" it said, and there was something like consternation in the tone. I told him in a hectic sentence, for I was beginning to feel badly rattled myself. "You've never been in greater danger in your life," said the voice. "Great God, man, what brought you wandering here today of all days?" You can imagine that I was pretty scared, for Sandy was the last man to put a case too high, and the next second I felt worse, for he clutched my arm and dragged me in a bound to the side of the road. I could see nothing, but I felt that his head was screwed around and mine followed suit. And there, a dozen yards off, were the ascertained lights of a big motor car. It came along very slowly, purring like a great cat, while we pressed into the bushes. The headlight seemed to spread a fan far to either side, showing the full width of the drive and its borders, and about half of the height of the overarching trees. There was a figure in uniform sitting beside the chauffeur, whom I dimly saw in the reflex glow, but the body of the car was dark. It crept towards us, passed, and my mind was just getting easy again when it stopped. A switch was snapped within and the limousine was brightly lit up. Inside I saw a woman's figure. The servant had got out and opened the door with a voice that came from within, a clear, soft voice, speaking in some tongue I didn't understand. Sandy had started forward at the sound of it, and I followed him. It would never do for me to be caught skulking in the bushes. I was so dazzled by the suddenness of the glare that at first I blinked and saw nothing. Then my eyes cleared, and I found myself looking at the inside of a car upholstered in some soft, dove-coloured fabric and beautifully finished off in ivory and silver. The woman who sat in it had a mantilla of black lace over her head and her shoulders, and with one slender jewelled hand she kept its fold over the greater part of her face. I saw only a pair of pale grey-blue eyes, these and the slim fingers. I remember that Sandy was standing very upright, with his hands on his hips, by no means like a servant in the presence of his mistress. He was a fine figure of a man at all times, but in those wild clothes, with his head thrown back and his dark brows drawn below his skullcap, he looked like some savage king out of an older world. He was speaking Turkish, and glancing at me now and then as if angry and perplexed. I took the hint that he was not supposed to know any other tongue, and that he was asking who the devil I might be. Then they both looked at me. Sandy with the slow, unwinking stare of the gypsy, the lady with those curious, beautiful, pale eyes. They ran over my clothes, my brand new riding breeches, my splashed boots, my wide-brimmed hat. I took off the last and made my best bow. "Madam," I said, "I have to ask pardon for trespassing in your garden. The fact is, I and my servant, he's down there by the road with the horses, and I guess you noticed him. The two of us went for a ride this afternoon and got good and well lost. We came in by your back gate and I was prospecting for the front door to find someone to direct us, when I bumped into this brigand chief who didn't understand my talk. I'm American, and I'm here on big government propositions. I hate to trouble you, but if you'd send a man to show us how to strike the city, I'd be very much in your debt." Her eyes never left my face. "Will you come into the car?" she said in English. "At the house I'll give you a servant to direct you." She drew in the skirts of her fur cloak to make room for me, and in my muddy boots and sopping clothes, I took the seat she pointed at. She said a word in Turkish to Sandy, switched off the light, and the car moved on. Women had never come much my way, and I knew about as much of their ways as I knew about the Chinese language. All my life I had lived with men only, and rather a rough crowd at that. When I made my pile and came home, I looked to see a little society, and I had at first the business of the black stone on my hands, and then the war, and so my education languished. I'd never been in a motor car with a lady before, and I felt like a fish on a dry sandbank. The soft cushions and the subtle scents filled me with acute uneasiness. I wasn't thinking about how Sandy's grave words, or about Blenkiron's warning, or about my job, and the part this woman must play in it. I was thinking only that I felt mortally shy. The darkness made it worse. I was sure that my companion was looking at me all the time and laughing at me like a clown. The car stopped and a tall servant opened the door. The lady was over the threshold before I was at the step. I followed her heavily, the wet squelching from my field boots. At that moment, I noticed that she was very tall. She led me through a long corridor to a room where two pillars held lamps in the shape of torches. The place was dark but for their glow, and it was as warm as a hothouse from invisible stoves. I felt soft carpets underfoot, and on the walls hung some tapestry or rugs of an amazing intricate geometrical pattern, but with every strand as rich as jewels. There, between the pillars, she turned and faced me. Her furs were thrown back, and the black mantilla had slipped down to her shoulders. I have heard of you, she said. You were called Richard Hanau, the American. Why have you come to this land? To have a share in the campaign, I said. I'm an engineer, and I thought I could help out with some of the business like Mesopotamia. You are on the German side? She asked. Why, yes, I replied. We Americans are supposed to be neutrals, and that means we're free to choose the side we fancy. I'm for the Kaiser. Her cool eyes searched me, but not in suspicion. I could see she wasn't troubling with the question whether I was speaking the truth. She was sizing me up as a man. I cannot describe that calm, appraising look. There was no sex in it, nothing even of that implicit sympathy with which one human being explores the existence of another. I was a chattel, a thing infinitely removed from intimacy. Even so, I have looked at a horse, which I thought of buying, scanning his shoulders and hocks and paces. Even so, must the old lords of Constantinople have looked at the slaves, which the chances of war brought to their markets, assessing their usefulness, and for some task or other, and with no thought of a humanity common to purchased or purchaser. And yet, not quite. This woman's eyes were weighing me, not for any special duty, but for my essential qualities. I felt that I was under the scrutiny of one who was a connoisseur in human nature. I see that I have written that I knew nothing about women. But every man has in his bones a consciousness of sex. I was shy and perturbed, but horribly fascinated. The slim woman, poised exquisitely like some statue between the pillared lights, with her fair cloud of hair, her long delicate face, and her pale bright eyes, had the glamour of a wild dream. I hated her instinctively, hated her intensely, but I longed to arouse her interest. To be valued coldly by those eyes was an offence to my manhood, and I felt antagonism rising within me. I am a strong fellow, well set up, and rather above the average in height, and my irritation stiffened me from heel to crown. I flung my head back and gave her cool glance for cool glance, pride against pride. Once, I remember, a doctor on board ship who dabbled in hypnotism told me that I was the most unsympathetic person he had ever struck. He said I was about as good a mesmeric subject as Table Mountain. Suddenly, I began to realize that this woman was trying to cast some spell over me. The eyes grew large and luminous, and I was conscious for just an instant of some will battling to subject mine. I was aware, too, in the same moment of a strange scent which recalled that wild hour in Capresso's garden house. It passed quickly, and for a second her eyes drooped. I seemed to read in them failure, and yet a kind of satisfaction, too, as if they had found more in me than they expected. "What life have you led?" the soft voice was saying. I was able to answer quite naturally, rather to my surprise. "I've been a mining engineer up and down the world." "You have faced danger many times?" "I have faced danger." "You have fought with men in battles?" "I have fought in battles." Her bosom rose and fell in a kind of sigh. A smile, a very beautiful thing, flitted over her face. She gave me her hand. "The horses are at the door now," she said, "and your servant is with them. One of my people will guide you to the city." She turned away and passed out of the circle of light into the darkness beyond. Peter and I jogged home in the rain, with one of Sandy's skin-clad companions loping at our side. We did not speak a word, for my thoughts were running like hounds on the track of the past hours. I'd seen the mysterious Hilda von Einem. I had spoken to her. I had held her hand. She had insulted me with her subtlest of insults, and yet I was not angry. Suddenly the game I was playing became invested with a tremendous solemnity. My old antagonists, Stumm and Raster and the whole German Empire, seemed to shrink into the background, leaving only the slim woman with her inscrutable smile and devouring eyes. Mad and bad, Blenkiron had called her, but principally bad. I did not think they were the proper terms, for they belonged to the narrow world of our common experience. This was something beyond and above it, as a cyclone or an earthquake is outside the decent routine of nature. Mad and bad she might be, but she was also great. Before we arrived, our guide had plucked my knee and spoken some words which he had obviously got by heart. "The master says," ran the message, "expect him at midnight." Today's music is a 1932 track by Russ Columbo, with a track called As You Desire Me.
As you desire me, so shall I come to you. However you want me, so shall I be. Be it forever, or be it just enough, as you desire me, let come what may. I doubt not but you will do what you will with me. I give my soul to you, you're my destiny. Come take me, my very soul is yours. As you desire me, I come to you.
And now we move on to the fourth and final part of The Mask from The King in Yellow. The same evening I took the keys and went into the house I had known so well. Everything was in order, but the silence was terrible. Though I went twice to the door of the marble room, I could not force myself to enter. It was beyond my strength. I went into the smoking room and sat down before the spinet. A small lace handkerchief lay on the keys, and I turned away, choking. It was plain I could not stay, so I locked every door, every window, and the three front and back gates, and went away. Next morning, Alkaid packed my valise, and leaving him in charge of my two apartments, I took the Orient Express for Constantinople. During the 2 years that I wandered through the East, at first, in our letters, we never mentioned Genevieve and Boris. But gradually their names crept in. I recollect particularly a passage in one of Jack's letters replying to one of mine. What you tell me of seeing Boris bending over you while you lay ill, and feeling his touch on your face, and hearing his voice? Of course, this troubles me. This that you describe must have happened a fortnight after he died. I say to myself that you were dreaming, that it was part of your delirium. But the explanation does not satisfy me, nor would it you. Toward the end of the second year, a letter came from Jack to me in India, so unlike anything that I have ever known of him, that I decided to return at once to Paris. He wrote, "I am well, and sell all my pictures as artists do who have no need of money. I have not a care of my own, but I am more restless than if I had. I am unable to shake off a strange anxiety about you. It is not apprehension, it is rather a breathless expectancy. Of what? God knows. I can only say it is wearing me out. Nights, I dream always of you and Boris. I can never recall anything afterward, but I wake in the morning with my heart beating, and all day the excitement increases until I fall asleep at night to recall the same experience. I am quite exhausted by it, and have determined to break up this morbid condition. I must see you. Shall I go to Bombay, or will you come to Paris?" I telegraphed him to expect me by the next steamer. When we met, I thought he had changed very little. I, he insisted, looked in splendid health. It was good to hear his voice again, and as we sat and chatted about what life still held for us, we felt that it was pleasant to be alive in the bright spring weather. We stayed in Paris together for a week, and then I went for a week to Ept with him. But first of all, we went to the cemetery at Sèvres, where Boris lay. "Shall we place the fates in the little grove above him?" Jack asked, and I answered, "I think only the Madonna should watch over Boris's grave." But Jack was none the better for my homecoming. The dreams, of which he could not retain even the least definite outline, continued, and he said that at times the sense of breathless expectancy was suffocating. "You see, I do you harm and not good," I said. "Try a change without me." So he started alone for a ramble amongst the Channel Islands, and I went back to Paris. I had not yet entered Boris's house, now mine, since my return, but I knew that it must be done. It had been kept in order by Jack. There were servants there, so I gave up my own apartment and went there to live. Instead of the agitation I had feared, I found myself able to paint there tranquilly. I visited all the rooms, all but one. I could not bring myself to enter the marble room where Genevieve lay, and yet I felt the longing growing daily to look upon her face, to kneel beside her. One afternoon in April, I lay dreaming in the smoking room, just as I had lain 2 years before, and mechanically I looked amongst the tawny eastern rugs for the wolf skin. At last I distinguished the pointed ears and flat, cruel head, and I thought of my dream, where I saw Genevieve lying beside it. The helmet still hung against the threadbare tapestry, amongst them the old Spanish morion, which I remembered Genevieve had once put on when we were amusing ourselves with the ancient bits of mail. I turned my eyes to the spinet. Every yellow key seemed eloquent of her caressing hand, and I rose, drawn by the strength of my life's passion, to the sealed door of the marble room. The heavy door swung inward under my trembling hands. Sunlight poured through the window, tipping with gold the wings of Cupid, and lingered like a nimbus over the brows of the Madonna. Her tender face, bent in compassion over a marble form so exquisitely pure, that I knelt and signed myself. Genevieve lay in the shadow under the Madonna, and yet, through her white arms I saw the pale azure vein, that beneath her softly clasped hands the folds of her dress were tinged with rose, as if some faint warm light within her breast. Bending, with a breaking heart, I touched the marble drapery with my lips, and then crept back into the silent house. A maid came and brought me a letter, and I sat down in the little conservatory to read it. But as I was about to break the seal, seeing the girl lingering, I asked what she wanted. She stammered something about a white rabbit that had been caught in the house, and asked what should be done with it. I told her to let it loose in the walled garden behind the house, and opened my letter. It was from Jack, but so incoherent that I thought he must have lost his reason. It was nothing but a series of prayers to me not to leave the house until he could get back. He could not tell me why. There were the dreams, he said. He could explain nothing, but he was sure that I must not leave the house in the Rue Saint-Cécile. As I finished reading, I raised my eyes and saw the same maidservant standing in the doorway holding a glass dish in which two goldfish were swimming. "Put them back into the tank, and tell me what you mean by interrupting me," I said. With a half-suppressed whimper, she emptied water and fish into the aquarium at the end of the conservatory, and turning to me, asked my permission to leave my service. She said people were playing tricks on her, evidently with the design of getting her into trouble. The marble rabbit had been stolen, and a live one had been brought into the house. The two beautiful marble fish were gone, and she had just found those two common live things flopping on the dining room floor. I reassured her and sent her away, saying I would look about myself. I went into the studio. There was nothing there but my canvases and some casts, except the marble of the Easter lily. I saw it on the table across the room, and then I strode angrily over to it. But the flower I lifted from the table was fresh and fragile and filled the air with perfume. Then suddenly I comprehended and sprang through the hallway to the marble room. The doors flew open, the sunlight streamed into my face, and through it, in a heavenly glory, the Madonna smiled as Genevieve lifted her flushed face from her marble couch and opened her sleepy eyes. The King in Yellow continues next time with In the Court of the Dragon. Well, that's it for today, except to tell you about a new card game that I've just released called Wipers Salient. It's a World War I theme solitaire deck-building game. You play the Allies trying to survive the attacks on the Ypres salient. The game is currently available from wargamevault.com. Opening music was provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Until next time. CthulhuPodcast.co.uk.